Our next guest co-hosts The Rest Is Classified, the espionage podcast sibling of The Rest Is History and The Rest Is Politics, produced by that global podcasting powerhouse, Goalhanger. And before that, Gordon Carrera was the BBC's security correspondent for many years. More recently, he's written a book that's been called a thrilling masterpiece of intelligence history. It's an extraordinary story that began when a strange Russian man walked into the British Embassy of the newly independent former Soviet Republic of Lithuania on the 24th of March, 1992. The British offered him tea. The man, as Gordon writes, would give them the secrets to the world. Gordon Carrera's book is The Spy in the Archive. Gordon, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Very good to be with you, Gillian.
So, who was that man who walked into the British Embassy in Lithuania?
Yeah, well, he looked a bit like a tramp, which was one of the problems, is he looked and he deliberately dressed down for the occasion. He was nearly 70 years old. The Americans had actually turned him away, which is an interesting story, partly because he looked so odd. He walks in and he says, I've got the secrets of the KGB, the Soviet Union's secret spy service, because I was the archivist of the KGB. And he is this extraordinary, and I have to say, quite odd character who had really understood the KGB better than almost anyone, because he joined it in the 1940s. He'd lived it as an officer of the KGB and had been the keeper of the KGB secrets as its archivist. And yet, unbeknownst to his, you know, his masters, he had turned against the KGB and became obsessed, and obsessed is the right word, with destroying the organization he worked for and what it represented. And so he's a very curious, interesting, and I think consequential character when it comes to the world of spies.
Indeed, you describe him as arguably one of the most important spies of the Cold War. What I also found interesting about The Spy in the Archive is that around this time in the early 1990s, it apparently wasn't that unusual for people to walk into Western embassies claiming to have KGB secrets. I wonder if you could elaborate on that sort of scene setting for us a bit.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why the Americans, the CIA, initially turned him away, because literally people were walking up to these embassies in Eastern Europe, in newly independent states, in like the Baltics, and going, I used to be in the KGB. I've got a bundle full of secrets. Give me $1 million and a house in Florida or in Hampshire. You know, I mean, that's really what they were saying. They would be like, I want this type of car. And you could see, you know, the spies were like, oh, here comes another. There was a joke in the CIA, another drunk KGB colonel, you know, turning up at our door, offering us a bag full of secrets. And orders went out to the Americans to say, enough. We're getting so many of these. We only want the very best. And so that was one of the problems for Mitrokhin, is that people didn't quite appreciate what he had. And he also, it was strange because he had these notes which were, he'd written up from the KGB files rather than the original files. And people were like, he's probably just another one of these guys trying it on. He's another one of these guys, you know, looking for the way out. And so it was a close run thing. It was a really close run thing, despite the fact he had something that no one else had. And it was fortunate that when he goes to the British Embassy in Lithuania, he meets this young woman who was not a spy. She was a diplomat, but she spoke Russian. She'd been in Moscow. She was in her 20s. And she just kind of goes, I think this guy's interesting. I'm going to give him a cup of tea, and starts to engage him. And it just shows sometimes those little human dynamics in the spy world matter so much, because I think she realizes this guy is interesting. And so then that will start MI6, the British Secret Service, coming out to check him out. And they realize, hang on, this guy isn't one of the other chances that we're getting. He's the real deal.
He was a deeply disaffected Soviet citizen. And as your title suggests, he didn't want to be an archivist. He dreamed of being a proper spy, if you like. And indeed, those aspirations brought him to Australia for the 1956 Melbourne Olympics. Could you tell us about that? And I suppose what then happened in his career that meant that he became an archivist?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the wild stories about it, is that he did not want to be an archivist. He liked files, but that wasn't the original plan. He really wanted to be a proper spy, you know, the kind of James Bond spy. But the truth was, he wasn't very good at it. And, you know, I mean, it's funny, but I think he struggled. You know, he does a posting in the Middle East and it just doesn't work out very well. He's not got the kind of glad handing, you know, cocktail party kind of manner that you're supposed to have as a spy to go recruit other people. So his first posting in the Middle East doesn't go very well. And then he's sent on these short-term postings to accompany KGB and other Soviet people going abroad to, if you like, keep watch on them. And that includes going to Melbourne for the 56 Olympics. And I found the file, actually, that is declassified from the Australian archives, which records him arriving on a boat, the Grazia, in 56, and them checking out, do we know he's a spy or not? This is the Australian, you know, security service. And they go, nope, we haven't identified him as a spy. He's supposedly a diplomat. And he has this wild time in Melbourne because it's a very interesting role, because as a KGB man accompanying an Olympic team, you're supposed to be stopping anyone defecting. You're supposed to be stopping any kind of games being played by the CIA or others. But there's a very famous water polo match called the Blood in the Water game, which is between Hungary and the Soviet Union, which takes place, I think it's a semi-final. And the Soviet Union has just crushed an uprising in Hungary in 1956. And so there's deep animosity between these two teams. I mean, so deep that it gets incredibly violent. There's elbows flying in the water and there's blood in the water. You know, people's noses are getting broken. And Mitrokhin is supposed to be kind of keeping an eye on this and stopping things getting out of hand. And instead, they go completely wild and it's a public relations disaster. And so it's, again, another disaster for this KGB man who's been sent to accompany the team to Australia. On his return from Australia, immediately after he gets back, they go, what are we going to do with this guy? He's not a great spy. Well, what do you do with someone who's not good? I know what. We'll put him in the archive. We'll banish him into the archive. He can't do any harm there, can he? I always think it's like the worst personnel HR decision in history is to send this guy to the archives, because what's he going to do? He's going to do some serious damage to the KGB, because he's in there and he's angry and aggrieved and is going to change in his ideology and come to hate the organization he's working for. And he's got access to all their secrets.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Gordon Carrera about his book, The Spy in the Archive, How One Man Tried to Kill the KGB. So far, Gordon, we've heard about the downturn in Vasily Mitrokhin's career that saw him sort of banished to the archives. Why was it, though, that he went from being banished to the archives to slowly and methodically copying out this extraordinary trove of Soviet secrets?
Yeah, it is interesting, because he comes back from Australia 56, sent to the archives. He doesn't actually start doing anything, copying things, for 16 years. So he spends years kind of getting more and more angry in the archive, watching what's going on in the world, seeing the truth about what the KGB is doing and how it doesn't fit with the way they're portraying themselves, and seeing his dreams of a kind of more open liberal communism disappearing. Eventually he decides, and it does become a spiritual obsession. He starts to see the KGB, and it sounds odd, but as like a monster, as like a kind of creature, a dragon almost. And he sees himself as like a hero from a Russian folktale who's going to destroy this beast. And he realizes the weapon he's got is his access to secrets. And then something fortunate happens, which is the KGB is moving office. And when you move office, the foreign part of the KGB, which spies abroad, you move your files. He's an archivist, so he's in charge of seeing which files go and which ones stay and how they deal with them. And he realizes, well, this is my opportunity to copy things. And so he's going to spend the next 12 years copying files. He sits in his office, the file comes in, and he scribbles it down on a tiny piece of paper, and then he stuffs the piece of paper into his shoe and then walks out of the KGB headquarters, goes home and writes it up in his dacha, his country house, at the weekend, and turns the little scribbled bit of paper with notes back into a file of the KGB's deepest secrets. And he's got access to pretty much everything, because he's an archivist. So he's able to take down secrets of agents abroad, the deepest cover agents, amazing secrets. And he's able to do this for 12 years, building up a copy of the KGB's archive under the floorboards, which is where he buries the notes, in his cottage out, you know, in the countryside. I mean, it's mad.
And it also means, I suppose, that for that period, there's kind of like an espionage time bomb sitting under his summer house. Based on your research into Matrokhin, do you think it was purely ideological or principled, the reason that he was doing this? Or was he also in some ways driven by guilt of his association with these things that he saw happening?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I think there's a mix of things. And of course, people like to portray themselves as being ideological, but often there's a personal motive beneath the surface. And with him, there's certainly a bit of grievance at having been banished and his career having been stymied. There's a bit of ideological hatred for the KGB and a kind of deep dislike of what it's doing to his country. And it's worth saying he saw himself as a Russian patriot, not as a kind of traitor, but as someone whose country had been kind of, you know, taken over by these spies and this secret service, and where it was his duty, his kind of compulsion to try and destroy them and defeat them. And he believed that the truth was his weapon. The odd bit about him is he's not at this point really a spy, because he's not in contact with MI6 or the CIA or anyone else. He's just doing it and burying it under his floorboards in preparation for one day he hopes being able to get it out. So it's a very odd, very interesting story about one man's effectively obsession, I think. And yes, there is an element of guilt to it as well, because he, of course, had been a KGB officer. He'd also been a prosecutor in Ukraine at the end of the Second World War when some pretty dark things had happened. And he never wanted to talk about them. He always would refer to it simply as the horrors. And I think for him, there was this sense of responsibility, of guilt at having been part of this machine that he then comes to hate and then wants to destroy.
And we know what the first part of the plan was in terms of copying out this material. Originally, what was his plan for what to do with that material?
Well, here's the thing. I don't even think he had a plan. I think that's what's crazy is you're doing this. You're risking your life burying secrets of the KGB. And he hasn't worked out what he's going to do with them. He hasn't worked out where he's going to take them. And by the time he retires in 1984, he's coming up with crazy plans because he's now accumulated like boxes and boxes and boxes. It's not like one file or one suitcase. You couldn't carry it out and just go on a plane. So he's thinking to himself, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how to get it across a border. He comes up with wild ideas. And so it's only really actually when the Cold War kind of comes to an end in 1991, the borders weaken, countries like Lithuania become independent. He suddenly thinks, now's my chance. Now I can take at least a sample of it over the border, show it to, you know, Western governments, and surely they'll be desperate for this stuff. But then the first people you show it to, the CIA, are kind of like, we don't quite get it. Who's this weird guy who's carrying a kind of bag of sausages with some files underneath, you know, and they ignore him. But fortunately, the Brits do eventually get him, and crazy operation to get him out of the country.
Yeah. So what were the conditions that Matrokhin had for passing over this material?
Well, it's so interesting because he meets MI6 in Lithuania and he says two conditions. One is, I want you to publish the material. So I'm not just going to give it to you secretly. It's back to his idea that he wants to tell the world and the Russian people about what the KGB was doing. So it's not as simple as just giving the secrets and then keeping them secret. But the second thing is he wants his family to come out with him. And his family means his wife, Nina, but also his mother-in-law, who's very old, and his son, Vladimir, who is in a wheelchair. He's got a progressive muscle wasting disease. And he says to MI6, I'm not coming out. And you're not having the files unless you get all of us out. And that becomes quite a challenge to get this family out of Russia without the authorities knowing, even when they're trying to smuggle them out. He hasn't told his son and his mother-in-law what he's been doing or where they're going when they're smuggling them out. So it becomes a bit of a family drama in terms of them suddenly realizing, we thought we're going on a medical trip out of the country, and suddenly they realize they're on an MI6 exfiltration mission.
The exfiltration is an extraordinary story. You mentioned there his son and the mother-in-law. That implies that his wife knew about the exfiltration. Did she know about the archive?
She really didn't know. All those years he'd been working on it, she had no idea what he was doing. I mean, he does strike me as the kind of guy who says, I'm off to my shed at the end of the garden. And she's like, there he is in his shed, yeah. You know, and he's actually copying the KGB secrets. So she had no idea. And he tells her just before they're getting out. And he thinks to himself, I'm not going to go if she won't come with me. She agrees to come with him, even though she's quite an eminent doctor in her own right and you know, a significant figure. But also, she says, well, I'm not going without my mother-in-law, without our son. And so they then got this problem because both of them, they know, might be reluctant to come out. So the decision is not to tell them until they're literally on the exfiltration mission when they work it out. And then, I mean, the son in particular, I don't think the mother-in-law, who's quite elderly, has a clue what's going on. I mean, that's what the MI6 people think. But the son-in-law, you know, I mean, the son is really upset, and it leads to a very dramatic confrontation between father and son, where the son realizes his father has been, you know, passing secrets to the West, and he's leaving Russia forever.
Gordon Carrera is the co-host of The Rest is Classified and the author of The Spy in the Archive. Gordon, what impact did the information that Vasily Matrokhin had compiled have when the Western intelligence agencies did actually get access to it?
The secrets were so big, so enormous, that it was almost too much for them to process. There were leads on spies that the US had never known about. There were leads, including about penetration of Australian intelligence,
yes,
which contributed to, you know, identifications of possible moles, although they weren't necessarily prosecuted. So there's all these leads he's providing about what the KGB had been doing. And yet, I think one of the interesting aspects of this is that the real importance of his story and his files was missed, because he comes out in the 90s, and it's in an era when people think the Cold War is over. People think the Russian security services are no longer a threat anymore. People think the KGB is dead. And so I think there's a sense in which they go, well, you know, this is very interesting history about past spies and agents. But what they don't see is that actually the KGB lives. I mean, it's living on, different names now, but actually they're very much some of the same ideology and even the same people, because who in 1999, the year Vasily Matrokhin kind of goes public with his archive, who becomes leader of Russia? A former KGB man, Vladimir Putin. In many ways, the KGB are returning. And what Matrokhin in his archive is saying is, you need to understand what the KGB was, what it was capable of, what its ideology was, what its operations were like, what its tactics were, because they still matter today. This isn't just about history, but it's about the operations today of Russia. And I think that was the real importance of his archive. It wasn't just the individual spy stories, but that wider lesson about the KGB.
And as you say, that's something that perhaps was missed in that broader sense, although something that Matrokhin himself was quite clear on and wrote about. What actually became of him personally?
Yeah, and this is almost, I think, the tragedy of his story. On the one hand, he gets out, his family gets out, he comes and lives in Britain. He, though, I think, can see that his old country, Russia, is turning back to some of the bad ways of the past with the arrival of Vladimir Putin. And he's writing about it in his last days, trying to say, listen to me, I can see, I understand the KGB better than anyone. You should see that this is what's still there. It's not gone. And he's trying to tell people that, but I don't think people listen. And so, I mean, he dies in 2004. Interestingly enough, he'd wanted to move to New Zealand. He'd kind of fallen in love with New Zealand, I think, partly because it reminded him of the kind of wilderness of Russia of his youth. But he dies early 2004. And I think, as I said, I think he's a slightly tragic figure, because on the one hand, he succeeded bringing out these files, you know, bringing out his family, getting them published. And yet somehow people didn't listen or want to listen to his real message, which is, there's an ideology there around the KGB and around Russian spies, which is dangerous and which persists.
Clearly, the information that he brought out was accessed by intelligence agencies in the West and not just in the UK. The information was shared. Perhaps you can also tell us why the US picked up some of the tab for that. But also, did Matrokhin get the part of the deal which was clearly important to him, which was the publication of the material he brought out?
the Brits get him out. It's very British, though, because they cost quite a lot to resettle a defector. And so the British Treasury go, I'm not sure we got the money anymore. Cold War's over, guys. And so the Brits then go to the Americans and they say, remember that guy you turned away? Do you think you could bankroll him? And they actually do. And they pay the money, which gets them access to the secrets. And initially, for the first few years after he gets out, the secrets are shared, with the Americans and with the Australians and, with other countries. The French have a lot of KGB agents who get found out. But then Mitrokhin had been pushing and pushing for a book to come out with his secrets. And it eventually comes out in 1999, co-authored by Christopher Andrews, a kind of eminent intelligence historian. It's a very difficult process, actually, because the two of them, they clash over it, and because Mitrokhin is so obsessed with what he wants to do and with this being his kind of legacy, that he's a difficult man to work with. I think that's no doubt true. But the book comes out and it's full of very interesting secrets and interesting information. But again, it's coming out in 1999 at a time when it feels a bit old. It feels like it's about the past. And people have not yet recognized that even though Vladimir Putin is about to come to power, ex-KGB man, that actually this has a contemporary relevance. And so I actually think it's only now, 2026, that you can see the importance of Mitrokhin, actually, in a way that maybe we didn't for many years.
What impact did the publication of the Mitrokhin archives have in Russia?
And that, again, is part of why I think there's an element of tragedy, because it really doesn't come out in Russia. He always wanted it to be for a Russian audience. He wanted them to see the truth of the KGB and what they'd done to the country. And the truth is it doesn't penetrate Russia. It doesn't get into Russia. It's published in the West and, read much more in the West. And so it doesn't reach the people he really wants it to reach, which are his own people.
What about within the KGB? What was the response to it there?
Yeah, it's interesting. Because at first, when the first kind of rumors that an archivist has stolen the files, they're like, no way. no one could have done that. It's impossible. And it's a disaster for them, particularly because he's copied the files rather than, if you like, stealing them. They don't know what he's taken and they don't know what the West has got. So suddenly, for all they know, all their agents are blown, all their deep cover spies are blown. It's a disaster.
And I didn't even notice he was gone for a while. Is that right?
Well, this is another bizarre part of the operation I discovered is, so he's retired by the time he leaves the country. MI6 managed to find a way for him to keep drawing his pension. And to make it look like, because he's got, he and his wife have got country homes and they've got an apartment in Moscow. Everyone in each location thinks they're at the other location. Everyone thinks, I haven't seen him for a while, but maybe he's in Moscow or maybe he's in this country cottage and, his pension's being drawn. So they don't know he's gone. So for years, he's sitting there in London, working on his files, and the Russians don't know that their deepest secrets have been taken. I mean, it is a wild operation in that way.
It's a truly extraordinary story. Could you give us your big picture view on what the story of the spy in the archives tells us or should make us aware of about Russia in 2026?
I think it is that there is a persistence in the ideology behind Russian spies, which survives the end of the Cold War, about their use of intelligence and intelligence agencies as a tool of power to do certain things. And there is a continuity in what Russia does. And for instance, in meddling with elections, we hear all about that. Well, did they meddle with the 2016 election in America? What have they been doing in other elections? Well, actually, if you go to the Mitrokhin archive, you can see how they did that in the past, how this was something they always did. And we kind of forgot those lessons. If you look at, we've had issues in the UK where Russian dissidents have been murdered. Alexander Litvinenko, Sergei Skripal, both Russian defectors who've been, Skripal's case, he survived, but targeted for assassination. Again, read the Mitrokhin archive. This is what they did in the Cold War. Propaganda, active measures, which they call their kind of covert influence program, going after dissidents, aggressive subversion of political parties, as well as, if you like, the regular business of intelligence agencies, which is recruiting agents. Russian intelligence does these things. It has always done these things. Under Vladimir Putin, a KGB man, it is bound to keep doing these things. We need to kind of understand that Russian intelligence intelligence is different. It's different from AZO or MI6 in its ideology, in its approach, in its tactics, and it's still there and still doing these things. And I think just that understanding is important for us in then not being surprised when some of these things happen, which are happening, you know, and they are happening in the world today around us.
Gordon Carrera, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Julian.
And Gordon co-hosts the podcast The Rest is Classified and is the author of the book The Spy in the Archive, the extraordinary story of how one man tried to kill the KGB.